I am Leanna Fuller. As Sarah has said, I do teach at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. I'm a professor of pastoral care there. I'm in my third academic year teaching at PTS. And in just a moment, I'll say a little bit more about my background and why this topic is of particular interest to me. But before I do that, I wonder, could I ask you to join me in a word of prayer as we begin? Let us pray. Gracious and holy God, we give you thanks for all the gifts of this day. We give you thanks that even on a day when it seems like maybe spring will never really come, we know that it is just around the corner. We give you thanks, God, that on a day when it seems like darkness and death may have the last word, we know that resurrection is not far away. We give you thanks, God, that we are an Easter people, that you have called us to be people of hope, to walk in hope even when we can't see beyond our own steps. We ask God today that for all of us who may be struggling in any way or wondering if daybreak will ever come, we ask God that you would send your Spirit to be among us, uphold us with your strength, and remind us that tomorrow is a new day. We ask these things in your name. Amen. So before I get started, I'm going to pass around quickly a little handout I have here. And this is really just for you to be able to follow along with what I'm presenting. Thank you. So essentially, it's just a basic outline of what I'm going to be sharing with you today so that you can follow along. Feel free to write on it if you would like to or not, however is best for you. I know that I tend to teach the way I like to be taught, and as a student, I always wanted something to hold on to, to know where we were going in the session, so that's what this sheet is for. And at the end of the session, I'll also hand out a list of further resources if you'd like to do more reading about conflict, if you're like me and have interest in the subject. I come from the United Church of Christ tradition, and I served a UCC congregation in Southeast Virginia for several years. And while I was serving that church, our national body, what we call the General Synod, made a resolution regarding same-sex marriage. Now, in our denomination, the national body can say whatever it wishes. It's really a call to the individual churches to think about an issue more fully. We're a congregational polity. Our General Synod has no authority to make individual churches do anything. And so this was really a call for congregations to think more deeply about same-sex marriage and about equality for LGBT folks. This was in 2005. Well, as you can imagine, there were a lot of people in individual congregations who felt strongly about this in both directions. And in my particular congregation, there were some people who were upset enough about it that they wanted to vote to leave the denomination. And this all sort of escalated very quickly. So within a period of just a few weeks, suddenly the senior pastor and I were having to try to figure out how are we going to deal with this very upset group of folks and who want to vote out of the denomination, and what will that mean for our church? So through that process, which I'm sorry to say was very unpleasant at times, I saw behaviors in our community that I would not have hoped to see there. I saw people that had been friends for 30 years stop speaking to one another over this. And it just made me really wonder, what's going on here? Why is this so difficult? Why is the not just this issue in particular, but conflict in general, so hard, it seems, for churches to cope with when it comes into their midst in this way? And why is it that we don't have better processes for dealing with it? Because I thought, surely, as I watched what was unfolding in my congregation, surely there has to be a better way. There has to be something better than this. So that's what really led me back to graduate school, to think and study about this issue for quite a few years as I was working on my dissertation, my PhD, my dissertation. So that sort of gives you a little bit of the backstory of why this topic is personally interesting to me. It's something that I feel like was really formative in my early years of ministry. And for me as a person, it just has taken on a real importance as something I feel like churches need to be talking more about, and that folks who are training in seminaries need to know more about before they get out into the workplace. But I wanted to say just a bit about the title, why I framed it the way I did for today. I've called my presentation Conflict, Suffering in the Faith Community. And I did that because I know for the past couple of weeks in this class, you've been talking about the concept of suffering and how that has been interpreted within our faith tradition. And today I want to pick up on that theme of suffering, but think about it in a slightly different way. Because I think when we hear the word suffering, we tend to think of it more in individualistic terms. We think about individual experiences of grief or pain or trauma and so forth. But destructive conflict in congregations, at least I argue in my dissertation, is often a communal form of suffering in many ways. That's what I saw anyway in my own experience. And it calls out for the same kind of attention that we give to those individual ailments, those individual forms of suffering. And that's part of the reason why, even though I locate myself as a scholar in pastoral care and in pastoral theology, conflict to me is still something that belongs in that discipline as something to reflect on, because when conflict happens in a community, people get hurt. And so I think it's incumbent upon the leaders of that community to know how to care for people in the midst of that, and hopefully to provide leadership that can make the experience less destructive than it might be. So today we're going to spend our time together sort of looking at the roots and effects of conflict in congregations, and also think about what kind of leadership is needed to help contribute to conflict being something that can lead to growth and transformation rather than suffering within the faith community. Because as you'll see as we go along, I actually don't think conflict itself is bad. I think it is a necessary and a given part of human life together in community. But the way in which we engage it, I think, is very important. So we're going to start with some outcomes for our learning time together. So again, teaching you the way I want to be taught. As a student, I always want to know, where are we going in class today? So today we're going to try to discard some fantasies, first of all, about conflict. In particular, the following fantasies. One, that there's a quick solution to conflict that will make everybody happy. I'm sorry to disillusion you, but I just don't think that's the case in most conflicts. And secondly, that managing conflict is about finding a quick way to get the other side, quote unquote, to capitulate. So if you would just agree with me, then we wouldn't have a problem, right? And I think we spend a lot of our time and energy in conflict trying to convince other people or persuade other people of the rightness of our position. And that's a normal human urge, I think, but I don't think it's always the most useful when it comes to conflict, particularly in faith communities, and particularly when we're dealing with issues of belief, right? Because people's beliefs are pretty ingrained, and it's not to say they're not subject to change, but if I think the only way we can solve this problem is to make you believe the way I do, we might have a real impasse. So that's the first thing I'd like for us to do today. The second is to find a different way of framing the issues or challenges that we normally call conflict. And then finally, to think about some specific techniques or ways of being that we can use to approach conflict in our ministry settings, as opposed to debating and arguing, which again is what we often tend to do in communities of faith, a very adversarial kind of model, which oftentimes doesn't get us very far. And sometimes it just kind of sets up gridlock more than anything else. So the first thing I like to think about together, and I'd love for you all to share some responses if you have thoughts. What kinds of things do churches fight about?
Knowledge and money.
Yes, money. Absolutely. Big one. Ted?
Sex.
Sex? Yep, absolutely. So sexuality, what's the proper boundaries around that?
Others? New pastor they don't like.
New pastor they don't like? Okay, so I would expand that to say pastoral leadership in general, because many times, whether the pastor's new or old, there tend to be conflicts around the person of the pastor and what he or she might be doing. Other thoughts about what churches fight about?
Status of worship.
Styles of worship, definitely. Anybody else got one? Haven't said?
Social issues.
Yes, social issues, more broadly, absolutely. Things that are happening out in our culture that people have different opinions about. Okay, so there are some things, of course, that almost all churches fight about at some point, and you all have named many of those. Research shows that pastoral leadership, worship, and money are really the top three that most churches tend to spend their time and energy in conflict about. And of course, pastoral leadership is a very broad category that can include a lot of things, but it's just generally anything that kind of relates to the performance of the pastor. But you also named a lot of other things, particularly in the terms of social issues. We could name a whole bunch of things that go under that category there. So one thing that I began to think about as I studied conflict and thought more about it is that many times it would seem, because churches fight about so many different things, that the content of the conflict, I think, often is not the real issue. Rather, it's the emotional intensity that comes with the conflict that can really get in the way of healthy functioning for congregations. So this is not to say that if there's a disagreement about, let's say, sexuality, that people don't really have strong opinions on that. They certainly do. But what I'm trying to say is that I think it's possible actually for congregations to contain difference around that issue without necessarily tearing apart. I think it is possible. I think the problem is when those conflicts take on such a high level of emotional intensity that suddenly it feels like we can't stay together. Now, of course, around sexuality, we would expect there to be really high emotion, but I have seen very vicious church fights over whether to use frosted or clear light bulbs. And I'm not making that up, okay? So when you think about that, you think, okay, that certainly can't be the real issue. You know, obviously there's something deeper than that that's going on. And usually that's true. If it seems like something really kind of superficial people are fighting about with a lot of intensity, probably it means there's something else happening. So really what we need to be thinking about in conflict a lot of times is not just what is the content of the issue, but what's the emotional intensity and where's that emotional intensity coming from? Because if there were no problem with emotional intensity, you can imagine that we would all just sit around and very calmly share our different opinions on social issues, and nobody would get upset because it would be like, you feel this and I feel that. But if there is intensity underneath it or around it, that's when it gets harder. So we're going to talk about that as we go along. So I'll ask you just for a moment. You can either write on your sheet if you want to, or just think to yourself. I'm going to give you a couple minutes to think. Thinking about this emotional intensity idea, what do you experience when a group gets caught up in an argument? So imagine yourself, whether it's in a group like this, or a session meeting, or some other group. What do you experience as an individual when a group gets caught up in an argument? And what do you think the group experiences when that happens? Take just a couple minutes to think or write something down if you would like to, and then we'll talk together a little more. Have a thought? Okay, let's get started then. Let's start with question one. Even if you're still thinking or writing, feel free to keep doing that. But let's start with question one just for a little bit. What do you experience when a group gets caught up in an argument? You have a response here?
Tribalism.
Tribalism? Okay. Can you say a little more about what you would mean by that?
People form into their tribe.
Okay. Okay.
And when the two tribes move to their extremes, it becomes more about the tribe, and often they don't remember why they're in the tribe.
Okay. So what you're describing in social psychology, they call it polarization, group polarization, where people tend to move to two extremes, and the people in the middle either kind of drop out or don't contribute to the conversation as much as the people on opposite extremes. Okay, other thoughts? Anybody have a thought about what you experience when a group gets caught up in an argument? Sarah?
I experience anxiety. I get upset and I'm
Yep, absolutely. And I find this is especially true if it's people that I care about, you know, that I really have an investment in the group getting along well. It seems to me the anxiety gets more intense when I feel like the stakes are higher. Okay, so Sarah said anxiety, yeah. Mm-hmm. Frustration. So frustration about what, the inability to kind of work through something? Or?
Yeah, just not being able to agree on that.
Okay, so that's sort of that feeling of getting stuck and we can't make progress toward our goal. Yes?
I'm using this and I'm always trying to figure out what can I say to ease the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so you're wanting to be a peacemaker, trying to figure out how to help the group move past that. I saw a response here, too.
I'm generally surprised and disappointed that someone has come down on the other side of the argument. I thought it was like-minded to me, and all of a sudden they're championing the other side.
Yes, I think what you're naming here, being surprised or disappointed that somebody is on a separate side than you, I feel like this is such an important piece of what happens often in congregations and certainly what happened in mine. Because what I saw was people saying, I've been to church with that person for 30 years and I never knew he thought like that. Which on the one hand made me feel like it's a little bit sad that you've been to church together for 30 years and you didn't know each other that well. But on the other hand, what I saw there was people discovered a difference that was pretty significant that they didn't know was there. They had assumed sameness on this issue with people in their congregation. And when they discovered that it wasn't sameness, that there was actually a lot more difference in the group than they thought, it became very troubling to them, anxiety producing as well. Okay, so I see Ted in the back and then one up here.
So I tend to get bored with it pretty quickly.
Okay, you get bored.
I'm like, why are we fighting about this?
Okay. Right. Okay. So feeling like this isn't really what we're here to do, that kind of thing. Okay.
There's a phrase that shows up in the gospel a number of times. I think the passage that comes to mind is where Jesus is asked what the greatest commandment is after he gives the shame on women. Classic answer. It goes on to say that the questioner wanting to justify himself I think people get caught up in that at times. It's not about the issue, it's about being right.
Being right. Right. So trying to justify one's own position. And sometimes when groups get polarized, it becomes very, very difficult for people to actually be able to take in new information or even change their mind about something because they have sort of staked this position and now it feels like part of their identity and they can't let that go very easily. I thought I saw a hand over here. Anybody have another one? Yeah.
Yeah, people fight the battle often over Bible verses that they select that support their perspective. So you have warring factions over the meaning of Bible verses.
Right. So there's some sort of selective choosing of resources, evidence to back up our claims.
And that just deepens their conviction to right.
Sure, of course. Yes, ma'am.
For example, to some degree, my parents didn't fight fair, and that's what I learned. So when I see an argument, I get nervous, and I'm thinking, oh. Now, fortunately, I've been able to change some of that. But I do think how we observed it as a kid does imprint on us.
Absolutely. Mine was a little bit the opposite. My parents didn't fight at all, at least not in front of us. So I went into my marriage thinking that healthy couples don't fight. That's what I learned through, you know, osmosis. And so, you know, learning that, okay, conflict is actually a normal part of relationships, as long as it's done fairly. That was a big hurdle for me in figuring that out as a young adult. I'm like, okay, this is actually normal. This is actually good for our relationship to figure out how to work out our differences. Yes, I think you're right, absolutely. And if you come from a family of origin where conflict tended to be very intense and that felt uncomfortable, then even a more low-level conflict may feel that way to you because that's what you're bringing from your life experience. Yes?
If done correctly, a group, I find that groups can experience growth, reconciliation, and a new coming together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's shift to that second part. What is the group experience? You're saying that if conflict is done well, if it's handled in a healthy way, groups can experience growth and transformation. And I think that's absolutely true. In fact, I think it's probably true that most relationships, if they handle conflict well, they can experience an amazing amount of growth. I mean, marriages are a good example of this. If a marriage is completely conflict-free, I feel like there's something that's not being named or said somewhere on one of the partner's, you know, behalf. Because I just don't think it's possible to be in intimate relationship with another person and not discover differences and not have to figure out how to work that out. Now, that doesn't mean every married couple is going to fight. Married couples deal with conflict in different ways. But to sort of pretend that we can have these perfect relationships or perfect communities with no conflict, I think is not realistic. And actually may prevent us from finding some really transformative opportunities, you know, where we could really get in there and work some stuff out together. Anybody else? What is the group experience from your perspective when a group gets caught up in an argument? How does it feel with the group? Yeah. Many of the same things we've said. Okay, so you can feel sometimes the group getting anxious, getting nervous, tense. You feel tension. Yes?
Well, the group doesn't have a clue what's really going on.
Many times that's true. Sometimes it's hard for the group to sort of self-reflect, right? An individual in the setting may be able to kind of step back and say, oh, I see what's going on here. But unless someone in the group can help lead the group to that kind of self-reflection, groups on their own typically are not able to do it very well. It's, you know, because they need someone who can facilitate that process, right? Which is why leadership is so important, as we'll get to in a little bit, to help groups be able to step back in the moment and say, wait a minute, what's going on here is maybe not the best way for us to handle our conflict, or what are some healthier ways we could engage this? Any other thoughts on what happens in the group when an argument comes to the surface?
Possible for a group to experience anything? Do corporations have First Amendment?
I think those might be two separate questions, but I do think there's a way in which individuals do have feelings, but then you can sometimes get a sense of a process, an emotional process happening in a group. So I see this all the time at faculty meetings, right? So individual ones of us have opinions, but then if something uncomfortable comes before us, different groups are going to have sort of different ways of dealing with that. And some groups have a dynamic of being really willing to just jump in and grab onto an uncomfortable thing and wrestle with it. Most groups, I would say, are not like that. Most groups tend to kind of take a step back and say, oh, I'd rather not deal with this, you know, and try to find a way to avoid it in certain ways. So there are processes and dynamics you can observe. Now, maybe you wouldn't call that what the group experience is. But I do think sometimes you can walk into a room and get a feeling, you know, oh, this group is really tense. and it's kind of, it may start with individuals, but after a while it starts to feel like the group is getting swept up in this. Which is a good segue into what I wanted to talk about next, which is anxiety, which was named as one of the things that people experience in the midst of conflict. What I have found that a lot of people experience in conflict is a sense of emotional intensity, or you might even call it dis-ease. In my work, I use family systems theory a lot as a tool to help me understand how this process of emotional intensity works in congregations and groups. And family systems theory, if you're not familiar with it, it's just a theory that basically tries to see problems less as contained within individuals and more as a result of systemic dynamics. Okay, so an example would be a child who all of a sudden starts failing in school. Now, an individualistic way of looking at that would be to say, well, this child has just decided to stop doing his homework, or he's, you know, falling asleep in class or whatever. But then if you were to find out that mom and dad are going through a divorce, that might change how you interpret his behavior at school, because what is going on at home may be really affecting what's happening in school. So the things are not disconnected. So systems theory is a way of seeing problems, what we call problems, more as responses to something that's happening in the system. So family systems theory tends to talk about this feeling of emotional intensity or dis-ease as anxiety. So what is anxiety? Well, according to the theory, it's the sense of threat that people or systems experience. So how safe do I feel versus how threatened do I feel? If you've ever been in a situation in a group where there's a lot of anxiety and tension, you probably notice that there's just a feeling of kind of, like people are just sort of, you know, tight and everybody's walking on eggshells, nobody wants to say the wrong thing. That's anxiety. It distinguishes itself from fear, though, at least within the theory, because fear is a reaction to the known. All right, so if you're being chased by a bear, that's fear, because you know what's chasing you. And the fear is actually really to your benefit, because it's telling your body to move, to get out of here. Okay? And it's a real threat. And knowing what we're afraid of, even though it's still difficult, it gives us a sense of control. Okay, I'm afraid of this thing, but I know what it is, and I know how to get away from it. Anxiety is less tangible than fear. Anxiety is this sort of more diffuse sense of threat, of like something bad might happen, but we don't know exactly what, right? So when we feel anxious, we kind of are like just in this heightened state of alertness and worry, but we don't know a lot of times exactly what we're worried about. It's not as tangible, we can't put our finger on it, and so we can't control it. And anxiety in a system, so we're thinking about individual anxiety, but anxiety in a system can work like a chain reaction. You may have seen this before. If there's someone in a group who gets really worked up about something, depending on the group, a whole lot of other people may also start to get worked up about that thing, who weren't upset a minute ago. Okay, so it can actually many times spread to other people. This is what I saw in my own congregation when there were a couple people who were really upset and they brought this issue to the business meeting, and all of a sudden, 30 people were really upset. It was like, hey, you all weren't that upset about it before you walked in this room, but it was like it kind of spread to other people. And it inspires a reaction to that perceived threat. It actually, the research shows that when we start to get anxious and have these sort of responses, we're having in our body the same kind of responses as we would be if we were facing a physical threat. So when people feel emotionally or psychologically threatened in some way, the same chemicals get released and the same neural processes start happening, and people actually become less able to think clearly in those moments. They become less able to take a step back and say, wait, let's look at this from a different point of view. Let's, you know, talk it out. People actually become less able to do that. They're responding from a more visceral place. And I certainly saw that in my congregation. The responses people were having were very, to me, uncharacteristic, because people were sort of acting and speaking in ways that I had not seen them act and speak before. And I realize now it's because their anxiety was so high and they were operating out of this much more emotional place. So what happens with anxiety is people react to a perceived threat, but even then reacting to the perceived threat creates imbalance in the system, and so that's threatening too, right? So you get into an argument in a group, and all of a sudden, even the thing that you're arguing about isn't making you anxious, but just the fact that you're arguing, just the fact that there's conflict in the room creates anxiety. So how well or poorly a system functions really has a lot to do with how the system handles anxiety. So you can probably think to yourself of groups or churches, places you've been a part of, where there might have been conflict or differences of opinion, but people were able to handle that pretty well, and it didn't turn into a big deal. You can also think of groups or families, organizations you've been a part of, and every little thing became a huge ordeal, right? You know, everybody's just reacting very strongly to everything. In that latter scenario, that means the system is having a harder time dealing with anxiety. That when there's anxiety in the system, people get much more worked up and tense. So what happens when the group gets more anxious? Well, the higher the anxiety is in a system, the more difficult certain things become, I think, around conflict. When level of anxiety or emotional intensity is high, conflicts start to be seen in very rigid terms as us versus them, good versus bad, faithful versus unfaithful. So this is what you were describing earlier about going to the extremes. There's a sort of a polarization that happens. And in psychological terms, this is called splitting. It means we're splitting these two things apart, and there's no way to bring them together. You're either over here or over here. There's no possibility for dwelling in that middle space, in the gray area, which actually I think is where most of us are many of the time on many things. But in this kind of conflict where anxiety is high, it becomes more difficult to do because people want the security of knowing we're either over here or we're over here. If you're not with us, you're against us, right? We want that kind of clarity, okay? But the problem is that when we are in situations where anxiety is high and conflict starts to take on this very rigid, sort of split apart nature, there's really only three outcome options when this happens. There's your group wins, your group loses, or leaves. Or loses and leaves. Or there's maintaining the ongoing feud. That's really the only three possibilities, is that one group is going to get its way at the expense of the other, or you're just going to keep the conflict going perpetually. Because if the only two possibilities are this and this, and we don't have any place to work in the middle space, then it's going to become a very adversarial kind of relationship, and it's going to become more of a competition where one person wins and one person loses. This is why I felt like in my own congregation, when people wanted to take a vote over leaving the denomination, I felt like taking a vote was not a good idea because I knew that it would create winners and losers. And it did. And the losers left because nobody wants to be a loser. It doesn't feel good. And it's hard to stay in a community where you feel like you argued passionately for something and people, you know, basically that's how it feels to you. Said, no, we're not going to do that. So what I would have hoped for in my own congregation would have been a process where things could have been less infused with anxiety, where there would have been more room for productive conversation, and maybe we could have said, hey, let's not take a vote on this right away. Let's have however many months of conversation about it and try to do a process of discernment to see if we can get to a place where we really feel like we're being led in one direction or the other. Unfortunately, many times people want certainty, they want clarity, and so they feel like voting is the way to get that because they'll say, well, we need to take a vote on this so that we can know what we need to do. And in some matters, I think that's right. I mean, we can't indefinitely delay all decisions. There are decisions that have to be made sometimes in a timely manner. But in this particular situation, it felt like we went to the vote much too quickly, and so people were forced to kind of choose that either-or scenario, and people whose vote, where the vote didn't go the way that they wanted, felt they couldn't stay because they felt like the division had become too great. So that's why I think we need to be worried about letting our systems get too anxious, because if there's a lot of anxiety in the system, conflicts tend to take on this more polarized quality. Whereas, as we were talking about earlier, there can be healthy conflicts, there can be ways in which conflict can be used for growth and transformation, but it's a lot harder to do if everybody is really anxious and everybody thinks there has to be an either-or solution. So we're talking about splitting. The process or the progression of conflict and splitting in congregations tends to look like this. So first, a difference surfaces. Right? And like we were saying, sometimes it's a difference we didn't know was there. we assumed we all thought the same way about X, and all of a sudden, wait a minute, you actually think Y. Okay, what do I do with that now? So the different surfaces. Now, I would suggest to you that part's inevitable. In any community or relationship, eventually difference will surface, unless it's somebody you just don't know very well. It's actually easy not to get into conflict with someone you hardly know, because you just talk with them about the weather and things that aren't that important, and you never get into any conflict. But anybody that you know well, or a community that you're a part of on a regular basis, there's going to be difference that surfaces. The next thing that happens is that subgrouping occurs. Okay, that's where groups form around their shared identity or their shared interests or their shared position on something. That part is really, in a large group, pretty much inevitable too. Even if it's something innocuous, like, well, this group has an interest in this. You know, they're going to form a group, or they're going to, you know, get together with people in their similar age group or something like that. That part is pretty inevitable. So those two things are not necessarily bad. But when the subgrouping is around issues that feel really significant or feel like they require a decision, arguments will start to break out, which is likely. Again, conflict being a normal part of human interaction, when there's difference in a group, there's going to be disagreements. I mean, we're just all different people. We're never going to be able to just magically all get to the same place on everything. And actually, I don't think that's what we really want anyway, because that would just mean we're a group of clones that all think and feel just alike, and I don't think that's the way we're created to be. So the arguments break out, that part is pretty likely, and then when the anxiety in the system is high, the power struggle increases in intensity. So here's where you shift from we're just having disagreements to one of us needs to win. And that transition from that sort of level of disagreement, which is totally normal and healthy, actually, for congregations, when you shift over from that to one of us has to win, that's where the danger lies. Because that's where you start to get into more and more intense levels of conflict, the higher the anxiety goes, and the more the group gets polarized, if you're not careful. And what you can eventually see is the polarization can be so extreme that the people in the middle, who most of the time are kind of a silent majority, they may actually just drop out, and all that's left are the two extremes battling it out as to which of us is going to prevail. Okay, and that's why we call it a power struggle. And then the final stage of that, if it really gets out of hand, is splitting. So where one group actually chooses to leave and maybe start a different congregation, or, you know, schism. I mean, it's like our church splits because we can't figure out how to work this out. And the splitting part is dangerous because it saps so much vitality and energy and morale from the congregation. That's what I saw in my own church. There was about 60 people who left out of a 250 member active membership. So that's about a fourth. And many of them were people who'd been there for a long time and were very important in the church. So it's not like the church just fell down without them there, right? But it hurt. It was very painful for the people who remained. And they felt a real loss from that. And it sapped a lot of the energy and a lot of the joy from the congregation because of what happened. So you may be thinking to yourselves, well, this is not good. You know, how do we stop this from happening in our churches? There are some ways, I think. I think the role of leadership is really, really important in these situations. And I'm not just talking about official leaders like pastors or staff, but lay leaders, even people who may not have official titles. But I'm sure you can think of people in this congregation that if I were to ask you, okay, there's a conflict brewing, we need somebody who is willing to come to a meeting and be a calm presence and, you know, help people stay centered and try to help keep the anxiety down in the room, you could probably think of people in your congregation who have those qualities. Those are your leaders also. Anybody who can help keep the anxiety in the system down is a leader by this definition. So, but the leaders, at least according to the family systems theory, can have a really powerful effect on the whole group. So the example that the leaders set is really, really important. Again, you've probably seen this before. If a leader goes into a room and everything's in chaos and the leader manages to stay calm and to be able to engage people honestly, it makes a difference. Whereas if the leader comes in and just gets all worked up and everything, him or herself, it usually doesn't help. It just adds to the chaos. So the leader who's able to stay connected with people but still manage their own anxiety can actually have a big effect on the group. And we talked about earlier, anxiety is infectious. Calm can be infectious too. It just takes longer, right? So anxiety spreads really quickly. Calm can spread too, but it just takes a little longer for the calm to kind of circulate through the group. And I always tell my students, you know, don't go into a room and tell people, be calm, because that really doesn't work. And it's actually not showing calmness on your part. It's showing that you're anxious. So what I coach them to do is bring your own calmness to the situation. People will see that. They'll sense it. You know, bring your own calmness, and that actually has a much greater effect than just telling people to be calm. Okay. So I'm going to suggest to you that trying to move from less healthy conflict to more healthy conflict, where there's less anxiety, requires a leader or leaders who recognize their position in the conflict. So if I'm the pastor of a church and there's a conflict going on, I need to be real clear. Is this conflict about me? Is it related to something that I'm doing? If not, can I take a position on something without seeming like I'm taking sides? Like, I have to be really, really clear about how I'm going to engage this, because it's going to matter with the people that are involved with this. It takes leaders who recognize the emotional intensity of the conflict. So can I tell, okay, is this a relatively normal disagreement? Or is this a conflict that's gotten up to here in intensity? And if it's up here, do I feel I have the skills? Am I equipped to handle a conflict like that? Or do I need to get help with this? I think one of the mistakes we made in our congregation is the senior pastor and I were just really not equipped to deal with a conflict that was intense as ours was. And looking back, I wish we had at least looked into the possibility of getting someone to help us. Perhaps a congregational consultant, somebody who works with conflicted congregations, somebody who could be seen as more neutral, that could come in and help us work with things. Rather than, you know, the senior pastor and I said, well, we have to stay with the UCC because that's where our ordination is. Well, people experience that as an ultimatum. That's not how we meant it, but that's how it felt to them. So it might have been helpful for us to have a third party to come in and say, hey, you know, let me help you work with this. I'm not invested in either outcome. But the literature says when conflict gets to a certain level of intensity, you almost always need outside help to help you work through it. Leaders, I think, need to recognize that the more intense a conflict is, or the more important it is, the more there's a need for a planned process, so deliberate steps that take time. Like, we're going to work through this conflict in this way, and here's how we're going to do it. Because just sort of haphazardly trying to deal with it doesn't work very well. And people need, you know, when we're talking about people being anxious, part of anxiety is the unknown. So if people say, oh, okay, here's how the leaders have planned we're going to work on this and how we're going to try and get to a solution. Even just having a structured process is calming to people because it's like, okay, we know what to expect. We're still anxious maybe about the outcome, but at least we know what's going to happen. The importance of ground rules are guidelines for the work that must be done. Okay, so another thing that I wish in retrospect we had done in our congregation would have been to lay some ground rules for our meetings where we were trying to work through this issue. Because what happened was, exactly what we've been talking about, the people who talked were the people who felt really strongly on either side. And basically what happened was they just sort of, you know, had a back and forth, many times very verbally intense back and forth, across the whole room, which mostly were people in the middle who never spoke. And who could blame them? Because they didn't want to get up and be attacked, right? So if we had had some ground rules about, okay, how long can people talk? How many times can they talk? What kind of language is acceptable or not acceptable for us to use here? How will we know if our conversation is getting too intense and we need to take a break? I mean, just these kinds of questions or working through those rules together, I think, would have helped us, because then we would, as a group, have said, okay, we all agree to these guidelines. And then if somebody started breaking them, we would have had something to go back to say, well, you know, we agreed. We wouldn't call names or whatever. Let's come back to the document that we created together and say, okay, here's what we agreed to. Let's try to make sure we're all doing that. But as I tell my students, you know, we call these behavioral covenants sometimes, and they can be great tools, but the problem is they're not very effective if you're not willing to enforce them. So when you create a document like that as a group, it's important to also be clear about whose job is it to kind of help hold everybody accountable. And what will you do if there's somebody who refuses to work within the guidelines? I mean, every group would probably have a different answer to that. But these are important questions to be asking. And then finally, the last thing I mentioned, a leader who recognizes the key role of a referee, that's what I call it, or a facilitator. And in lower level disagreements, this can be the pastor or other leaders from the congregation. As I mentioned a minute ago, in very intense conflicts, it's harder for those people to be the referee or facilitator because they're recognized as having a stake in one side or the other of the issue. And so it's harder for them to function as a more objective presence. And sometimes things can really be helped by having somebody who's not necessarily invested in the outcome come and work with a group to help them find a solution to a problem. But, of course, that requires, you know, the willingness of the group to have someone from outside come in. And it would be worth a lot of conversation with the group about who do we know, perhaps in the community or in the presbytery, that we think could help us with this, that the congregation would trust. Because trust is a really important piece of this, too. So I think leaders, if they know these things and can be clear about them, it can really help with conflict, particularly when it's in that more anxious kind of a space. And so along those lines, I have three suggestions, specific suggestions for leaders. And again, when I say leaders, I mean really anybody in the congregation who can come and help bring the level of anxiety down and function as a calm presence. But the first is to acknowledge difference in anxiety. As I said before, I think a lot of times what happens is people discover difference where they're not expecting it, and it catches them off guard. So one of the things that might help sometimes is just to acknowledge, hey, we have a lot of different views of X in our congregation. Or in our congregation, you know, there are different points of view on this particular biblical theme or whatever it may be. Just to say that, yeah, there's actually a lot of difference within our group. Although we may all be Presbyterian here and we may all kind of believe in these particular tenets of our faith, there's a whole lot of wiggle room even within that as far as opinions about different things, social issues, those things that we talked about in the beginning. So just acknowledging difference and anxiety can help. And, you know, saying this is hard, like this is anxiety producing for us to acknowledge there's different things here. The second thing is to cultivate calm and connected leadership. And I'll say more in just a minute about what I mean about that. And then the final one is providing opportunities for all voices to be heard. As I said, in our experience in our congregation, there were a lot of voices we never got to hear because of the way we structured those meetings. That was our loss, because there are a lot of people in that silent middle who would have had a lot of good things to contribute to the conversation, but they never felt safe to do it. They felt like they would just be attacked by one side or the other if they started to talk. So if I had it to do it over, I would design a planned small group process that would let people have a much safer environment where they could share thoughts about things. And that way get a lot more input as to where people really were with this. Now, when I've said this before, you know, somebody said to me, well, does that mean, you know, you just let somebody say whatever they want all the time? And I said, no. It does not mean letting people bully others or, you know, let people get bullied. Providing opportunities for all voices, to me, means everybody gets a chance to speak. But nobody is allowed to dominate or to behave in ways that are disrespectful. It's just the same thing I do in my classroom, or I try to. I say, every voice here is valued, and my job as the instructor is to make sure that people who wish to contribute get a chance. And that may mean that if you're a quieter student, I may ask you to contribute more than you have been. If you're a more talkative student, I may ask you to hold back a little bit to make sure there's space, okay? And I'm also in charge of making sure that nobody engages in disrespectful or abusive behavior. That's my job as the instructor. So it's a very similar kind of thing in a congregation. We can make space for everybody to be heard, but that doesn't mean we let people act in ways that are harmful or disrespectful. And that's where the behavioral covenant can come in. So the last thing I'll mention is, what is calm, connected leadership? That's the second point I made on the previous slide. Basically, what I'm trying to convey there is that those who bring a lower level of anxiety, a higher level of personal safety, while remaining connected to others, they become leaders in a group. Whether or not they have a title or a position, they become people that can really influence the group in a positive way. People who are able to have, as I call it, a less anxious presence, who have the capacity not to get swept up in anxiety in a group, who can kind of, you know, stay calm through that, but yet at the same time stay connected to other people, okay? Because sometimes people think a less anxious presence means, well, you just don't let anything affect you. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is people who can be really closely engaged with the group and connected with people, and yet at the same time be clear about their own position and do that in a very calm and non-anxious way. Those are people that can actually have a really positive effect on the group. I would suggest that the job of leadership is to help keep down the level of anxiety in the emotional system of the congregation and not to feed it. So there are some leaders who may actually be more in the feeding realm, and usually that's not very helpful when it comes to conflict. You know, you don't want somebody who's a leader to be the one convening the parking lot meeting after the meeting, right? Because that's usually not helpful. It stirs the anxiety and keeps it going, rather than saying, what can we do to kind of help things settle and be in a calmer place? Because as we've talked about, when people are in a calmer place, they don't have all those extra chemicals running through their body, they can think more clearly, and they can communicate with less intensity, usually. And so another thing about calm, connected leadership is managing one's own anxiety. This is key. And I talk with my students a lot about this, and they always say, well, how do you do it? How do you do it? Well, it's a lifelong project in a lot of ways. It's not like something overnight. You can just discover how to manage your anxiety. But I think the first step is being aware of it, being in touch with ourselves enough to know, when am I getting anxious? What are the kinds of things that make me anxious? How could I prepare for a situation that I know is going to be anxiety-producing? Could I spend time in prayer and meditation and reflection before that situation to help center myself? And then when you're in the anxiety-producing situation, trying to be less anxious than most people in the room and trying to stay connected and in meaningful contact with other members. So again, being less anxious doesn't mean I just stand up here and I say, I don't care what you all think. It's not going to affect me. It's more like being able to handle strong emotion that's coming from different parts of the room and not needing to fix it and not needing to run away. That's really a less anxious presence. Being able to be in the presence of strong emotion and not need to fix it and not run away. But basically to be able to say, okay, I see what's going on. Now let's work together on how we're going to work through this. So again, it's not telling other people to be calm. It's bringing your own calmness to the situation. I think I've got a few minutes left, so I'm going to stop there. That's really all I have for my presentation, but I'd be glad to take a couple of questions if anybody has any. Yes?
You mentioned small groups, and it occurs to me that how you constitute those groups matters.
Mm-hmm. That's right. How you constitute a small group within a small group process is really important because you don't want to have somebody who's going to dominate the small group, right? And then it's not really fulfilling the purpose you want it to have. Now, a small group process, like I talked about, that's not something you would use for every single decision-making process, right? I mean, you're probably not going to use that when you're deciding on something relatively minor, because that's very time consuming. But if it's something that's very, very important and has the potential to really create a lot of anxiety and intense conflict, that's a place I think you might want to consider doing something like that. And there are guidelines for that type of thing in terms of how you structure the groups. One thing that can really help with that is having people who have had a little bit of training be facilitators in each small group. So again, having somebody who's there whose responsibility is to notice when somebody hasn't said anything or somebody is saying too much and not leaving room for others. The facilitator role can be really, really important in those processes. So that's one thing I would say. But then also, you know, having some wisdom about, okay, these two people really don't get along. Maybe it's not best to have them in the same group. You know what I mean? Like, let's try and spread out, you know, the people who are most likely to feed each other's anxiety. And that's where I think pastoral wisdom and the wisdom of the lay leadership is important. Other questions? Yeah.
Our senior pastor, Dr. Jim, he did this point by point by point. He didn't miss any of it when we were discussing how my session was on session
okay.
at the time. Same-sex marriage. We needed to make a decision about that for Presbyterian
right.
assembly, etc. It took almost a year.
Yes.
And he did every single one of those. And when it was all said and done, the vote was taken, and he said in a session meeting that to his knowledge, there was one family, one couple that left because of the decision, but they left right up front with him. They discussed it. They thought the process was fair. It just was something.
Right.
There were other people who didn't agree with the decision. However, it wasn't a deal breaker for them.
Right.
There was so much else, and also the process of how it was done with such care and respect and love that it wasn't a deal breaker. So it's amazing. And those of you, any of you were at the Jewish Christian Dialogue the other day, that was also a master class that he presented to two about the situation taking place in Israel and Palestine. He gave a presentation. Half of the room was Jewish.
Right.
So we are very, very fortunate. We have all of this.
I'm so glad. I mean, your point about process is so crucial, because even social psychological research will tell you that when people feel they have had an opportunity to have their voice heard in a meaningful way in a process, they are much more willing to live with a consequence or a choice, even if it's not the one they would have made. So even down to people with court sentencing, if they feel they've gotten the chance to have their story heard fairly, they're much more willing to accept their sentence, even if it's not what they wanted. You know, but they feel like, okay, I got to say my piece.
Function
okay.
a small group. So
it's a great idea.
That was very helpful, I think. And then it was open to other people also different times. But anyone that wanted to have input about this issue had that opportunity.
Excellent. Okay, one last question here.
Well, just to reinforce how important your topic is, Presbytery tells us we were the only church in the entire Presbytery that did what you just described.
Is that
only one. And all that says is that, you know, these skills that Jim has that you advocate are rare.
Right. I mean, and unfortunately, I think conflict is something that, because most of us would rather avoid it, many times as leaders, we just kind of are like, you know, I don't want to deal with that. If it comes up, we'll deal with it. Well, that's actually a reactive way of dealing with something rather than a responsive way. So the senior pastor and I at the church we served, we could have been more proactive. We could have said, hey, this thing is coming in General Synod. There may be people who will be upset about it. Let's talk about it in advance rather than just letting whatever happens happen and then having to react, which we were not in a good position to do. So I think that shows not only the leadership skills, but the wisdom of your pastor in being able to see down the road, this is going to come, so let's start now and do some work so that we can have time. Because that's the thing, is good decision-making like that takes time. Well, thank you all very much for coming today. I have one last handout for you. I'll just pass it out quickly. It's some just additional resources for reading if you're interested in this topic of conflict. A little something I put together for another group, but I thought you might like to have it too.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Put two over here.
Thank you.
Just one? Okay. There you go. Yeah.
Thank you.
Here you go. Could I leave some extras with you?
Yeah.
In case folks in the choir would want some. Hey. Well, thank you all very much. My email address is on the back side of this page I just gave you, so if you ever want to be in touch about any of this or anything related to this topic, I'm glad to be in further conversation with you. Thank you.